I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. As business mergers and acquisitions accelerate and business becomes more global, communities are wondering where the next crop of civic leaders will come from. David Luboroff, executive director of the Rappaport Institute at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, has looked in detail at business influence on one of America's most newsmaking transportation projects, Boston's Big Dig, and what he found gives hints of what may be in store for other cities. He's our guest today on Smart City. And to talk about civic involvement on a completely different scale, we have with us Bob New. He's an activist with the City Repair Project in Portland, Oregon, where citizens take over intersections in their neighborhoods and remake them into public spaces. We'll talk about civic involvement, large and small, today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. David Luboroff is the executive director of the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He is the co-author of Mega Projects, as well as many articles and case studies on the politics of decision-making for transportation, land use, and other forms of infrastructure. He was a columnist on infrastructure issues for Governing. Before joining the center, David worked for the Boston Redevelopment Authority, where he edited the agency's landmark 1988 Midtown Cultural District Plan. The involvement of corporate CEOs in cities is changing dramatically. I know it has in Boston with mergers and acquisitions. You've studied that involvement, particularly using the example of Boston's Big Dig. What did you learn about how CEOs influenced that project?
CEOs, in general, our study of the Big Dig, which was part of a larger project on the study of major urban infrastructure projects, found that it's very, very rare that one of those projects goes forward without the active support of a city's business community. This is true particularly for highways and airports, sometimes less true for transit systems, and also true for things like arenas, stadiums, and convention centers. What's interesting, as you pointed out, is that the traditional sources of local business leadership, which were often locally owned banks, locally owned utility companies, and locally owned manufacturing firms, have been slowly disappearing. There are fewer of each of those, and each of those kinds of entities has less incentive to become involved.
I'm curious, David, you made an exception for transit, and I'm not surprised that you did, but do you see any new civic and business support developing around that issue as a way to fight traffic congestion and reduce parking needs in central cities that are once again developing and redeveloping?
I think there's a lot of interest in transit, and it is an interesting point to ask, why did we find less involvement in transit? You know, the simple answer is that business leaders, like most people in politics, become involved when there's a problem that affects them directly. I'm a firm believer that much of political involvement results from people understanding their self-interest and where they believe there is a plausible scenario for how to address their concern and that some entity has the capacity to actually take those actions. I think the issue with transit is, in part, downtown businesses have generally been strong supporters of transit. When you run the numbers, it's very hard to make a compelling case that a lot of the transit projects that get discussed are going to have significant impacts on either traffic or air quality issues for a variety of reasons that we can discuss. So I think in some cases, you know, the business interests just say, look, it's not completely clear to us that we get the kind of payoff from this that we expected. Now, having said that, business interests have been, you know, pretty involved with most of the major efforts to expand or build new rail transit systems, because in some cases, while transit may not be the answer, it may be the only feasible answer. And so doing something that will make a marginal improvement is generally better than doing nothing at all.
But as you said, business people tend to get involved when they have a concern, they have a problem. So are big infrastructure projects and capital projects being driven by what make sense from the public perspective, the common good, or in fact, are they being driven by someone's good idea or trying to solve someone's problem who gets passionate enough and is savvy enough to work the project through the system?
I think the answer is C, some combination of both of those. It's very clear to me, I think when you take projects apart, like the Big Dig and like other major infrastructure projects, that the coalition in support of projects like that, as is always true with coalitions, different people come to those coalitions with different agendas and they make judgments. If you and I are in a coalition together, that doesn't mean that we agree with each other. It means that we've made a judgment that each of us has a better chance of achieving our goals by working with each other. That's the definition of a coalition, in my opinion. Hopefully, given that the American political system is one where it's virtually impossible to do anything unless you have consensus, a coalition in support of a major undertaking, and you know, it's what we're talking about, is the mobilization of huge amounts of resources, has to be almost always a pretty wide coalition, which means hopefully that the action is something that a lot of people support and is there in the public good. The problem with a lot of projects, unfortunately, is that most people, most of the time, don't choose to become involved in politics. So you often have a smaller cadre of folks who care for a variety of reasons about projects, usually claiming to act in the common good. Sometimes when you run some of the numbers on these, you wind up questioning whether that is in fact the case. But what's Churchill's old line about democracy? It's a terrible system of governments, except compared to anything else that we've ever thought of.
But surely 6,000 earmarks in the transportation bill can't mean anything good for how we're investing our money in streets and roads and transit.
It's very clear if you look at the earmarks that the distribution of earmarks essentially tracks the relative power of the people involved in the process, committee chairmen and senior legislators, particularly from the party in power, always does better in that system, and this bill is clearly no different. It's not completely clear that it's a terrible way to make decisions. A good politician doesn't earmark just anything. A good politician goes back to his or her district and finds out what kinds of projects have broad consensus in the district, right? The reason you get earmarks is because you want to be perceived as bringing home, you know, your district's fair share of projects. So, and the good transportation departments, by the way, know this quite well. And so, you know, they'll tee up the projects that they like and sort of hand them off. It's still, in many respects, I think you're right. Distributing available goods on basis of seniority is hardly a system designed to lead to the most efficient allocation of resources. And what it really tells you is that since the end of the interstate highway system, a program that's been winding down since the mid-'80s, there really is no overriding or overarching national transportation policy. You know, we have essentially a certain pot of money that's available, and we're trying to come up with a list of items that equal and usually exceed that pot of money. Let me just push this point a little bit further. Before the interstate highway system, which is funded in the Eisenhower era, although the idea goes back to the late 30s, roads and bridges were seen as primarily a state and local responsibility, which is to say, they're critical to the quality of life and the economic functioning of regions, and therefore people have a tremendous incentive to invest in relatively good roads within their region. There is a role, clearly, for a national government to, you know, make sure we have an interconnected system so that the road in Massachusetts actually connects with the road in New York, although Massachusetts and New York have great incentives to do that. And what you're seeing right now is, with the end of the interstate system, this vision that we needed a national system of interconnected highways, there is no overarching national vision because, in many respects, roads, bridges, and I would argue, by the way, in many cases, transit systems, are not fundamentally and obviously a national problem. One might actually look back to the early Reagan years where Reagan proposed a deal where he was going to turn the highway program back to the states and he was going to take all the health care issues. The states turned that down, fearing it was going to be a bad deal. If the Bush administration were to put that deal back on the table, the states would jump at it in a minute, but hindsight's always 20/20.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is David Lubaroff. He's the executive director of the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. I want to revisit this issue of CEO involvement in infrastructure project and the larger issue of involvement in communities and what happens when mergers and acquisitions result in a declining population of those people who are operating at enough scale that they can have an impact on employment and on civic decision making, on funding of projects, etc. What have you seen in Boston? What has been the result of some of the mergers that you've experienced there?
This is a really very interesting and very important question. A little piece of history here. In Boston, as in many cities, there was a CEO-dominated group called The Vault, which was founded in the late 50s and was really quite active into the 1970s, reemerged for a while in the early 80s. And its members were the CEOs of about 8 or 9 locally owned banks and several utility companies, retail stores, insurance companies. Of the, I believe, 9 banks that were original members of the Vault, the only one that still exists in name is the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and that one's not going to go out of business. And of the utility companies, I think it's Boston Edison, I believe, is the only one that still exists as an entity headquartered in Boston. So these were folks whose economic stakes were tied very closely to the region. They had great incentive to be involved. Now, almost all, probably actually not almost all of the people involved with the Vault for most of its history tended to be white men and often of only 1 or 2 ethnicities to boot. So this was a fairly narrow group of people who exercised tremendous influence. I think some of the things they did clearly helped Boston in its economic restructuring in the latter half of the 20th century, but some of the things that they strongly supported came at great expense to low-income communities, particularly minority communities. They were strong supporters of urban highways, strong supporters of the expansion of Logan Airport, for example, strong supporters of urban renewal. All things that had an arguable justification, but all things that in Boston, as in most other American cities, came at an enormous price. Now, fast forward to today, you don't have the same number of people who are involved. Even where you have locally owned firms, the major firms tend to be global. So Fidelity, for example, is still headquartered in Boston, but Fidelity is an international firm. Its fortunes, in the end, will not rise or fall on the fortunes of Boston, except to the extent that when it's competing for top-notch managers, they're going to think about, is this a city I want to live in? Is the quality of life one that I like? So it's much harder to mobilize that kind of muscle, as it were. It's much harder, truthfully, for people mobilizing like that to say, as their predecessors did, well, we've hired experts from places like this university and others, and the answer is fill in the blank. I think really since the civil rights era and the Vietnam War, that kind of an argument just doesn't hold any water anymore. I think it's much, much more difficult to mobilize that kind of action. Now, having said that, what's interesting is there are still enough people whose economic fates are tied to the region and enough people who live here and who care about the region and who are successful, and regions like Boston, which have attracted entrepreneurs, who view the region as a place that they wanted to set up business because there were certain aspects of it that they liked, that those folks are trying to figure out ways to become involved, both as a set of issues and as a mode of operating. One of the questions that I've been wrestling with more recently is, in many respects, it's not at all clear that these people are getting involved with the same entities or in the same ways as their predecessors, and so therefore conclude that business is less active in civic affairs or people are less active in civic affairs. And I just worry that we're like, that old story of the drunk found looking for his keys under the lamppost, and somebody starts helping him look and then says, well, where did you lose them? And he says, well, it was around the corner. He says, well, why aren't you looking there? And he says, well, because the light's over here, right? If we only look at the historic institutions, for example, that are Boston-centric, by Boston-centric I mean, focus specifically on downtown Boston, we do run the risk of perhaps missing entities that are in our suburban areas, because Boston, like many other areas, has had significant population and job growth, out on its periphery. somewhat less than other regions, but still significant. And we may wind up missing a whole variety of other forms of civic involvement. So people might not be in the vault, but, you know, they may still be on the boards of their local hospitals. They may be involved in their religious institutions. They may be involved in youth soccer leagues. I've been stunned sometimes when you look at who runs youth soccer leagues, at the executive talent that goes into scheduling fields and making sure referees are there. But all of those activities, my colleague Bob Putnam argues, and I think he's correct, build a network, a sort of civic network, that can mobilize when specific problems occur. I mean, the number of conversations that occur before and after meetings that are held for one purpose, the conversations that occur for another purpose are often the most important part of that meeting. So, sorry for such a long answer.
No, it's a good answer. Let me ask you, though, about involvement on the other end of the spectrum, and that is global involvement. Today it's easy to be involved in a global cause, say an environmental cause or a development issue in Africa as an example, which maybe 20 years ago was much more difficult and much less available to someone living in a community. So getting involved in global organizations that may have no local presence at all is probably another trend in involvement. But then I guess the question is, who then tackles the big issues that are indeed local? I mean, there's local youth soccer leagues are a good thing, and global causes are a good thing, but there's still issues in cities.
Yeah. Who's going to roll up their sleeves and try and help us figure out how to fix the schools?
Exactly.
I think you're absolutely right that people have gotten more involved in a wider variety of causes. And again, that's one of the reasons why you'd want to step back and not make the kinds of assertions that even I will sometimes make, that civic involvement has declined. It looks like it has, but I'd want to be a little bit cautious in that. On the global involvement, right, there is a difference between global involvement in the form of sitting down and writing a check to any number of very worthy organizations. The whole emergence of sort of mass marketing organizations, you know, focused on specific causes, including, you know, a number of really laudable organizations doing sort of global aid, is a relatively recent phenomenon, certainly the last 3 or 4 decades. And the whole mass mailing pitch and how you raise money and its more recent evolution in the last few years to tapping involvement through the internet is fascinating. But I'm not sure that that's a kind of involvement, right? You send money, you feel okay, and then you just go back and do whatever it was that you were doing. The involvement that matters, money is a wonderful thing for a lot of these undertakings, but the other involvement that really matters, and I think the involvement you're asking about, is when somebody puts time, somebody puts their name to something. You know, it's one thing to get a letter. You know, I'm always amused. You know, I get letters from Paul Newman, you know, asking me for money. You know, I don't know Paul Newman, right? Maybe you do. You know, that one gets sort of tossed pretty quickly into the recycling bin. You know, if my neighbor calls me and says, there's something going on, you know, I need your help, then, you know, it's a lot harder for me to say no. It's a little easier if I get an email. It's harder if I get a phone call. And it's really hard when they sort of show up at my door and say, there's a meeting on Tuesday and we really need you. But that's hard. It takes a lot of time. We know that Americans in general are working more, at least those that have survived the recession. And the ones who are getting jobs back from the recession, you know, are probably working as hard, if not harder, than they did before. So there is this problem of this sense of a, you know, not having enough time. I believe the great study in urban politics, or one of the great studies, is Robert Dahl's Who Governs? Study of politics in New Haven in 1961. Now Dahl missed a couple things. I mean, I think he missed the significance of race in New Haven at the time. But one of Dahl's great concepts is that at any given time there's something called slack resources in the system, which is if a problem gets big enough, people who have not been paying attention to politics will begin to get involved because they're concerned about it. And whether it's a larger cause, think about something like the emergence of civil rights as a moral issue, or sort of the growing frustration with the Vietnam War. You may be seeing some of this with the Iraq War. Or if it's a very local problem, right, people will, at the margin, you know, begin to make decisions to get involved. They'll start going to meetings. They'll start writing letters. And the the great beauty of the American political system is, although it moves slowly, they'll start electing people to office who are articulating their concerns and supporting those people as they try to address it. But for all the reasons we've discussed, in some ways it becomes a little bit harder because we've turned over more and more of those aspects of our lives to the professionals, whether it's the professionals who, you know, who work and run interest groups, whether it's the professionals who run our, you know, our large institutions. And every once in a while there's this sort of fight between kind of professional norms and community values.
Mm-hmm. There certainly are. You're hinting certainly at one way to engage people today, and that is to define the larger cause, the compelling cause. Another certainly is to organize activity or volunteer activity as projects and not ongoing commitments. Are there other things that you've learned in studying civic involvement and civic leadership that suggest ways to re-engage people in those activities that are more effective today in getting people once again committed to civic engagement?
I mean, I think you've nailed most of the key lessons on the head. I think there's a very interesting tactical problem, which is the Artery Business Committee in Boston, as you know, was founded to address a specific problem by a specific group of people. That big dig is more or less done. It will come to an end at some point. And the folks behind the Artery Business Committee are sort of wrestling with this question about, should this entity continue? And one side of that argument says, no, we came together to do something. It's done. We should go out of business. And the other side says, you know, there's an extraordinary network here of people who have become involved, and it would be stupid to pack up shop. Surely we can mobilize this network for something else. We'd hate to waste this capacity. The answer's almost certainly somewhere in between, which is that over time, and it's already started, entities like the Artery Business Committee, founded to address one problem, will morph as they identify another problem. And one of the interesting things about the Artery Business Committee is, if in fact its members judge that the next activity it gets involved with is not all that important to them, they'll either stop paying their dues, or probably more likely, they'll stop coming to meetings, or they'll send, you know, instead of sending the top tier person, you send the second tier person or the third tier person. And this is different. There's a different model than the old vault kind of model, where there was a group of business leaders who were always involved and then tried to pick the issues that they thought had risen to the top of the agenda. In other cities, by the way, there are still pretty active business groups, and in many cases these are new forms of old groups. On your question about new ways to get involved, I think there's some new techniques. Clearly, as you know, people are making much better use of information technologies to quickly mobilize people around an issue, e-petitioning, just the way an email can go out and get people to come out to a meeting. But in the end, I think the basics of community organizing never change, which is identify an important problem, identify a plausible solution, and break it down into the chunks that people believe that their actions are likely to produce a desired result. People are loath, in my estimation, to go to 100 meetings for no real reason other than that civic involvement is a good thing. People will go to several meetings to address, if you can say, you know, we're trying to address the problem of, this is the old Saul Alinsky, if you're organizing a community, start with a couple small victories that people can see work. The other possibility is to organize a set of activities that aren't explicitly political, but that are bringing people together to do something that they enjoy, you know, and whether that's getting together to discuss a set of community issues. I mean, there's a subset of people who like that, or starting a reading group, because, again, going back to the Putnam point, having those networks in place that you can activate when things are really bad is clearly really important. So in some ways, it doesn't necessarily matter why people are in the room, just as long as you can get them in the room. And that's in our, you know, culture of 500 TV channels and iPods and MTV and broadband internet. That's a challenge. I think it's harder, but the underlying principles never change.
David, this was fun. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
I've enjoyed it too.
David Luberoff is Executive Director of the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about another infrastructure issue, public transit, and in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Bob New about Portland's City Repair Project. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, there are a couple of researchers, and I'm going to use that term in quotes, Randall O'Toole and Wendell Cox, and they have been the leading transit critics in America. Every time there is a proposed transit system in an American city, you can bet that Wendell Cox and Randall O'Toole will both be on the scene at some point with their speeches and their PowerPoints telling the citizens of that community why investing in transit is a really bad idea. And now someone has taken on the critics.
This is a fascinating phenomenon that we have today. It's sort of freelance researchers and who build their careers as critics. And there are these two guys. They're independent of one another. But they sort of mirror each other in their techniques and in their philosophy. O'Toole and Cox, there is not an objective bone in either of these people's bodies. That is, they make it clear very, very early and up front that they don't like transit. They don't even like the notion of public planning. But they have a kind of aura of objectivity about their critiques because they cite an amazing array of statistics, which they say are drawn from third parties. Now, up to this point, they've been very little challenged in their use of these numbers because most folks who are involved in transit have day jobs. That is, they're already running a transit system or they're doing something else, and they didn't have a chance to go back and audit the numbers and sort of see where the numbers come from. Well, finally, there is such a person. His name is Todd Littman. He runs a Canadian-based transit think tank called the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. It's based in British Columbia. And he's gone through the work of these two men, and he says they're cooking the numbers. They're not looking at numbers that make transit look good. They're deliberately ignoring some numbers. And they're not counting numbers when they compare transit to highways and the auto transportation industry that would make auto travel look bad, like specifically the cost of the car itself. You know, when you get a transit system, you get the cost of the vehicle as part of the deal. When you're traveling by car, you individually have to buy the car. Also, the cost of parking. You have to have a place to park that car, and the cost of insurance, and so on. And Lippman says that when you do it fairly, when you really do look at all the costs associated with one mode of travel versus another, then transit starts to look a lot better. There's one other thing about Lippman's work that I particularly appreciate, and that is he's sort of casting, I think, a fairly realistic look at, or he's creating a look at transit that I think is far more realistic than most people have. Littman says it's not cars or transit, it's and transit and how they work together. And he says that transit's great advantage is it's a rush hour tool. It is much better than building all the highways that you'd have to build to accommodate peak travel. With transit, if you can take 5 to 20% of the traffic off those highways, the highways will work better and transit will work better and the cost of transit can be justified. So 5 to 20% off the major corridors leading into a city is real doable, and he says it's cost effective.
Otis, thanks for finding that one. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Bob New is the coordinator of the City Repair Project in Portland, Oregon. The City Repair Project is best known for transforming intersections in Portland. Where did the idea for the City Repair Project come from?
It came from a group of neighbors in southeast Portland. They got together at one point and decided that they wanted to do something to create community and bring people together in a certain way. And so they created what they called a tea house, which was a natural built structure that people can come into. And it just grew and grew and grew until it got to a point where people just knew about it. And it started from about 20 people getting involved to 30 people to 50 people to almost 500 people visiting and just doing this great celebration in this area. Unfortunately, the city of Portland at that point decided that it wasn't a structure that was built according to code or according to any kind of permits. So there was a bit of a struggle in the beginning of city repair's history with the city of Portland until they decided, you know, this was things that the community was doing that was increasing the livability of Portland. And it was something that people didn't have the money to do on the state or the city level, but they were able to do at the local level in a better way. So it just grew from that concept, and communities have been putting together projects and just gathering as communities from that point on.
Well, tell me about this original structure, and was it permanently installed? Did it move around? Where was it put, and what happened there?
It was a temporary structure that was built on someone's property, and it was basically a place where people can come to gather for tea and just talk or get to know each other as neighbors. And it was built from natural materials, sticks, branches, whatever people found. It was cob, included in the structures. We found materials like windows and things like that. And that was a temporary structure that got taken down over time. Then, after a couple of years, the City Repair Project created a movable tea house and a tea pony. I guess they called it. It was a tea horse. And it was a truck that went from neighborhood to neighborhood. And people got together and came and gathered around the truck. And the truck had these wings that were created out of bamboo and plastic. And people can throw pillows underneath and just gather as communities. So for a while, we were going from park to park around Portland. And that's how people really got to know what City Repair was all about. It was bringing people together in one area and just getting to know them as friends and community members.
How did intersections and transforming intersections become part of your work?
It was more of taking back our neighborhoods. A lot of what City Repair is trying to do is to get past that structure of a city built according to the grid, where it's built just for cars. So you look down a street and you just see cars and no people gathering. And you look down a typical street in any neighborhood and you can be anywhere in the country. And what we're trying to do is create communities where people have a really safe place to gather and people really feel comfortable in coming out and can express that creativity in their own neighborhoods, so they don't have to travel too far to go to a place that would be for their entertainment. They can just, you know, go outside and maybe go a block even, if that's like the longest they would go. But it would be a place where people can gather and to get to know the people that live around them and to dispel that isolation feeling that Americans feel so much in this country.
So explain what you do to intersections. I mean, give me a picture of what it is that compels people to come out of their houses and gather a block from home.
Well, one of the earliest intersections was we did a project on each corner. And when we say we, it's more of the community that does it, because City Repair just pretty much facilitates the process and helps communities get together. We don't actually go into the communities and do the actual projects. We just connect with the different resources that we know available. The ideas are coming from the community itself. So this one community in Southeast Portland decided to build a little house for kids where they can come and play, and it's right on the corner. And there's another corner at that intersection that has a tea sharing station, another corner that has an area that you can share resources or food or vegetables or books, things of that nature. So a lot of the different intersections that have been done around Portland have a variation of these ideas, from just painting in the streets. There's one in the Sunnyside neighborhood that's a huge sunflower that pretty much stops people in their tracks when they're coming across this intersection. And it's like, whoa, what is this? It's just something out of the norm where people say, okay, we're going to slow down, we're going to take a look. And as you slow down, you get to see some other projects in that area that have been done, like a cob bench or a little waterfall coming down someone's property into this area that comes out into a bench where people can just sit and, you know, relax and take in the neighborhood a little bit more.
When you approached the traffic engineer in the city of Portland about the idea of converting street intersections into public gathering places, did he run you out of the office?
I think at first there was definitely a little bit of a struggle between, like, the typical traditional, this is how we do things in the streets. But at this point, we do a 10-day conference in the spring called the Village Building Convergence. And we had 17 projects done this year. And the Portland Department of Transportation was actually disappointed that we didn't have more in the streets that were going on. They're getting more excited about it now, and they want to see that creativity come little bit more out.
What role does the city play in now in facilitating these projects or helping out?
Well, one of the things that came out of that first project back in 96 and 97 was an ordinance that the city of Portland passed that anywhere in the city of Portland you can do these type of projects. And so the whole process is getting neighborhoods together. And the city of Portland basically just requires each community to get approval from each of the four properties that live in that intersection, as well as 80% of the neighbors in any direction. So there is a whole series of meetings and conversations that take place where people are deciding, you know, what we want to see in the community, what we want the community to turn into, how we want to share our children's space. And eventually this project emerges from there. And it could be a 3-month process, it could be a 9-month process, it could take like 2 to 3 years. But working with the city is definitely an important part of that, where we are getting this help and support on that local level where people are saying, yes, this is something that we can do and we can help you out with the resources.
And the process of getting the neighbors together over some period of time must be important to your whole notion of community.
Right. And there's usually a core people that start this process in place, and whether or not that same core people continues throughout the process, it remains to be seen as we go along. And it's usually bringing a lot more people into it, and it merges and it diverts into this different process that people are just creating something that they didn't even expect to see in the neighborhood.
What makes a great public space?
Somewhere that people can come, that they feel safe, and they feel like they can have a place they can get away from the rigors of a city. And so a lot of the different areas that you see here are definitely car-driven. And so if you can get away from that a little bit more and just relax and have that feeling melt away, that's, in my definition, what a public space should be in sharing that community with other people.
You talk about turning neighborhoods into villages, one work party at a time. What, in your mind, is the difference between a neighborhood and a village?
A neighborhood is a smaller version of a village, and I think that in Portland or different cities around the country, you see different neighborhoods making up different villages within the city. And so there's definitely a different flavor as you're... I ride my bike everywhere in Portland, and so I feel it as I'm riding along, whether or not it's interacting with people or going through specific streets, but there is a difference in how people get together and how people are gathering in their spaces. And so neighborhoods, I feel like, are a version of villages in different ways, but different neighborhoods could come together to make a larger village. And so I think that's what we're trying to create in Portland, is to bring all these neighborhoods together to create this big village. And that's why the building convergence in the spring is really important, because we're bringing together so many different projects and then sharing with each other and what's going on and how excited we are in the process and how that community is brought together.
Do neighborhood businesses also participate in city repair project? In other words, is this just for residents, or do businesses join in?
We're going to be, I guess, hitting up businesses a little bit more as we're going along. We have been getting a lot of support from businesses in different ways, from just donating materials. Like the Rebuilding Center in town is a great resource for us to get donated materials. But as well as we do an Earth Day celebration in Portland, which brings together a lot of different businesses, and they're the big support that helps make that celebration happen. But I think as we do develop more and more projects around different neighborhoods, people are going to be fundraising for those different projects within neighborhood, and they'll be able to ask local businesses if they can support, and hopefully businesses will start to support these projects and maybe even have different projects outside their own business. So right outside our city repair office, we have a Kung Fu studio next door, and they decided to host a bench, and they helped to create this bench, which is an amazing, beautiful bench that's built out of Cobb. And so more and more, I think we're going to see part of that as City Repair gets its name known around Portland and around the country.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Bob New. He is project coordinator for City Repair Project in Portland, Oregon. anyone who's ever tried to do a project like this on public land or even private land, but it's necessarily the responsibility of the property owner, they run into insurance issues, legal issues, and pretty soon it's like, heck with it, it's just too complicated. How have you managed to negotiate those sort of thorny issues that get in the way?
There could be thorny issues that come up all the time, and they vary from project to project, but we've been able to work with a local company with insurance that has been really helpful in navigating through these different challenges. And so we've been able to do these different projects. And a lot of the projects that we do are very kid-friendly, and so there's lesser, you know, risk of people getting injured from power tools or big machinery that is not really used when you're building cob, when you're mixing the sand, clay, and straw together with your feet, and people are barefoot around, and it's just more of a community setting, so there's not as much risk in that way.
Do you have a champion at City Hall?
I think we have a lot of champions right now. We're pretty excited about the local group that's right now in City Council, and as well as just the history of what Portland has done in the last 25 to 30 years, and it's been a really progressive city that something like City Repair and other organizations can come together and do these sort of really exciting on-the-edge projects.
You run City Repair Project mostly with volunteers. How many staffers do you have?
Right now I'm half-time, as well as a bookkeeper that's half-time, and that's it.
And that's amazing in this age of professionalization, I'm surprised.
It's pretty spectacular. We definitely are going through some growing pains where we are experiencing more and more interest from different cities. And so we're needing to get a few more people that are trained in talking about city repair to go out and to do this sort of training to different neighborhoods so that they're able to just develop city repairs in their own cities or towns. There's already a few. There was 12 different communities that came to our Village Building Convergence back in May, from Seattle to Los Angeles and the Bay Area to Ottawa. And it's really exciting to see it grow in this way. And so we're needing to possibly pay for a few more people to do specialized things in that. But on the whole, it's been amazing to see that it is a volunteer-run effort because it is from the communities. So people are gathering within their communities to do these projects. And we're just more of the support saying, okay, well, this is how you do this.
Does the City Repair Project or your projects attract people of all ages? Can kids show up and be useful?
Oh, kids are definitely one of the main attractions of our city repair sites. We're very excited, and a lot of the pictures that we show do have kids like playing with cob or painting in the streets or part of the celebrations. And the celebration is the main part of what the project is all about, too. It's getting people in the streets and saying, you know, this is what we're doing, that we're taking back the streets in some way. And so people are really excited, and they come out of the houses, and kids are definitely a huge part of that.
Okay, Bob, you've mentioned it three times, and so now I have to ask, maybe I'm the only one who doesn't know, what is cob?
Cob is a natural building technique that uses clay, straw, and sand. And so you mix them together in different proportions, and you can come up with a bench or come up with walls that are really well insulated. We've just finished with a huge project at the Rebuilding Center, which is one of our projects with businesses in the area, that was a 3-foot wall, and it raises up probably like 20 feet in the air, and it's the main entranceway of the site. You can do a lot of creativity with cob and creating different faces or trees or different designs in the cob that just look a lot more beautiful than just a cement or a brick wall.
Has the City Repair Project, in your mind, left a permanent mark on the city of Portland?
I think so. Our name is definitely known around different areas, but more importantly, it's bringing people together and knowing that, you know, City Repair has helped to create this family community within different neighborhoods. And so you go through and you might see the sunflower in the street, and that's like, wow, look at that. That's amazing. Or a cob bench, and you're looking at the intricacies of how the cob was made. But in the sense that people come together and, you know, they're starting to know their neighbors a lot more and creating that family atmosphere within neighborhoods, that's probably the most important mark that City Repair has made.
Bob, the projects sound great. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Bob New is project coordinator for the City Repair Project in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
Our cat Fred is 18 this year. He's in reasonably good health, even though he's suffering from kidney failure and we have to give him fluids every other day. In the past year or so, he's lost a lot of weight, but his appetite is undiminished and his attitude can be just as feisty as ever. His vet thinks he might make it to 20. Fred's longevity is noteworthy, but not unusual. Indoor cats routinely live as long as 15 to 20 years or more. Shielded from viruses and other risk like cars and dogs, cats can live out their full allotment of 1 billion heartbeats. Biologists have found that the average lifespan for all animals is roughly equivalent to 1 billion heartbeats. The varying lifespans of different species are a function of how quickly those 1 billion heartbeats are expended, and this is correlated with size. Larger animals tend to have slower pulse rates, so they live more years than smaller animals. The underlying principle is known as quarter power scaling. For example, since an average cat is 100 times more massive than an average mouse, it lives 100 to the quarter power longer, or about 3 times as many years. But however many years it takes, both cat and mouse will live for 1 billion heartbeats. In my amateurish medical biology, a billion heartbeats accounts for a lot of things. In particular, it suggests the ultimate reason why good diet, regular exercise, no smoking, and stress management are so important. Anything that makes us hypertensive speeds up our heart rate and thus uses up our 1 billion heartbeats that much faster. I've read that Lance Armstrong's resting heart rate is in the 40s. Mine is in the 60s, so compared to Lance, my heart is beating about 29,000 times more often each day. Add that up over a year, and it's 10.5 million more. Now, that's but a small percentage of a billion, but over a lifetime, it gets to be a big difference. Now, just to say it again, this is amateur medical biology. But I use it as a way of enforcing some discipline in my lifestyle. We all want to maximize the years of our lifespans, but it's hard to put the goal of more years into practice. The trick is to translate years into something we can manage directly. Converting years into heartbeats does that, because we can do specific things to reduce our heart rates, such as good diet, regular exercise, no smoking, and stress management. And we know that success in these things will help us live more years because they slow the rate at which we use up our allotted 1 billion heartbeats. Of course, Fred is doing just fine without any of this tomfoolery about heartbeats. But people are different. We need a practical framework for governing our lives. The long-run statistics just don't hit home. They're too abstract and thus fail to motivate us. So I focus on the one thing I can literally put my finger on, the pulse of my heartbeats, which is as close to home as you can get. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.